Good evening. Thank you. Yeah. Welcome to Whitworth's Dean's Dialogue. We have this event every semester now, and what we seek to do during this discussion is to take up a controversial intellectual issue or political social issue for discussion. In the past, the issues that we've taken up have been on, you know, things like faith and science, that sort of thing. Tonight, we're going to focus on the upcoming election, and we've brought together four faculty to talk about that. But prior to that, I want to introduce myself and introduce them. I'm Michael Leroy. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Faculty here at Whitworth. We convene these events in part so that students can see that we, as a faculty, are actively engaged in issues, and we want to model the kind of engagement and discussion, dialogue, and disagreement that we think is integral to being an intellectual community and a Christian community. We're also interested in modeling civil disagreement, disagreement in ways that treat one another with respect, while at the same time exchanging views and sharing different perspectives and so on. So we've got a great panel here tonight of faculty, and we always try to pull together a different group every time we gather. I think there's a little feedback back there. If you can get that, that'd be great. And what we'll do, the format for tonight is our presenters will present their perspective on the upcoming election for about 7 minutes, and they'll each have that time, and Scott McQuilkin, who is our speakers and artist director, will be there with the stopwatch and ready to cut them off at a moment's notice. They'll each give a presentation, and then I'll ask them a couple of questions to get started and with the dialogue part, and then we hope that during the latter part of our conversation you'll chime in with a few questions yourself. We are recording this tonight for podcasting, and so we would ask that when you do have questions, you wait until my assistant Carol Merrill brings the microphone around to you, so that your question can be recorded for eternity. So, without further ado, let me introduce our panelists tonight. On my right, far right, Lindy Scott is a professor of modern languages in Spanish language. He's been at Whitworth now this is his second year that he's starting. It feels like he's been here even longer. It's great to have him here from Wheaton College. He also is someone who ran for Congress back in the 2006 election. He ran in the primaries, and so he brings a lot to us here on the campus. Sharon Mulry, who's a professor in the School of Education and has her instructional leadership here class here tonight with her, right? Where are you? Yeah, woohoo! All right, it's good to have you here. And good for you to come and see your professor as an engaged citizen in this dialogue. So Sharon's been at Whitworth for 8 years, and it's great to have Sharon here tonight with us. Martha Gady, Associate Professor of Mathematics. Great to have Martha here as well. And you've been at Whitworth year 25. Wow. Congratulations. It's a special anniversary then. Great to have you here as well. Mike Ingram, Professor of Communications and our Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Scholarship. And Mike has been here about 20 years? 21 years. Okay, so we've got some relatively new folks and some fairly seasoned folks. And I want to get out of the way and let them give their presentation. So I'm going to pick Mike Ingram first, and then we'll go from there, left to right.
I appreciate y'all coming tonight. There we go. I'd love to share in the beginning three things with you. When I engage in talking about politics with friends, with family, with colleagues, with folks at church, there are three ideas that I proceed on. One is that I'm right. Now, since I was in junior high, I've enjoyed reading about politics and studying world affairs, and I started reading U.S. News and World Report when I was in eighth grade. That tells you how whacked I am. And I've enjoyed following and participating in the activities related to politics. And so if I'm going to take a position, I believe that I'm right, but I've got to be able to back that up with reading and with analysis and with homework and some research. Probably like the vice presidential candidates Thursday, you're not going to hear me talk much about the bailout because I haven't read much about it yet. So I'm not going to take any kind of stand on that because I don't have much information on it. But things about which I have read, the Iraq War or President Bush's foreign policy or how our state government ought to approach a particular issue, I believe that I'm right. I think most people do. But I've got to have some sense of evidence and background to support that. The tricky part is my second point, because I hate to admit this, but I could be wrong. And I have to remember that when I go to talk about particular events. I have to recognize that people who hold contrary views, they're not stupid. That many of them have thought carefully, that they've read in detail, that they have intelligent things to say. And not only do I need to listen to them, I need to be able to think about how my arguments and their arguments coincide, and to recognize that I might, in fact, be in error. Now, if any of you were here last spring at the Dean's Dialogue, the discussion was about religious plurality and religious tolerance on campus. And my dear friend and my dear colleague, who's not with us tonight, was one of the panelists, Jim McPherson in Communication Studies. Jim and I say this about each other in public often, that we don't understand how somebody who is as committed to Christ and smart and as intelligent and compassionate and as a good professor as he is could be so wrong about a great many things. And so if I think that X is the right way to proceed and Jim thinks that X is a bad idea, I have to listen to Jim. And I have to have some understanding that he could be right and I could be wrong. That really relates to the third point upon which I would base this, and that is a sense of respect in relationship for other folks. I want to tell you a short story. When I was your age, my roommate and another friend and I went camping, and we did guy things, and we played games, and we got into talking about theology. And it came out that Don had become a universalist and a Unitarian, quite apart from conventional Baptist and Christian understandings of things. Well, there was such a heated debate and dispute about that content that it ruptured their relationship permanently. And here we are in the woods, and my two buddies are yelling at the top of their lungs to one another. And since 1983, they've really not spoken to one another. Now, I'm not likely to be a policymaker on the political realm. You're not going to see any Ingram 2010 buttons probably on campus. And so when I engage in intellectual and political arguments with people, that's got to happen in the context of relationship and respect for them as people and as human beings. Now, I think their arguments have to stand up to scrutiny, as do mine. They have to demonstrate some evidence and proof for their claims, as do I. But I don't think that I want to engage in the kind of name-calling or destructive panel of communication that you see some people engage in. I know a lot of conservatives who are attracted to some of the ideas articulated by people like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, but they're so off-put by the manner in which those commentators communicate. And the same on the left. People who believe in the things Keith Olbermann subscribes to, but hate the condescending way in which he belittles people who disagree. So you've got to recognize that we engage in political life and in theological life in a sense of relationship, in a sense of community. And so to do that, that calls me to listen to what people have to say, to respect them as individuals, even if I think their idea is wrong. That needs to govern how we engage. I don't think you see a lot of that in the modern political campaign, in our city, in our state, on the international stage. My hope is that as you, who were students, leave us one day and go out into the world and do amazing things, I hope that you will articulate ideas. I hope that you will be right if you take the conservative line, and I hope that you will engage with people in a respectful way, just as Brother McPherson and I do in our often, in our frequent lunch conversations. I hope that that would be a kind of model that we can engage in. And so watch us, not just tonight, but watch all the faculty on campus and see if we're doing what it is that we say. When we talk about political statements or when we engage one another, are we doing that in a way that represents Christ and represents good intellectual honesty and humility. Thanks.
When I was asked to be part of this discussion, I was kind of like, why? I feel like I'm kind of apolitical. Probably mainly because my reaction is discuss politics, not me. I tend to hide in my foxhole so I don't get shot from either side. I tend to view myself as an independent, not because I'm halfway in between the right and the left, but more because I want to make my decisions issue by issue, person by person, and I don't want to be put with what I see as some power-hungry political parties who take a kindergarten attitude, if you don't play with my ball right, I'm not going to let you play in my court. It feels like it puts me in a battle that I'm in the middle being shot at from both sides. There have been times I've been told my views are unchristian and that they are uninformed and not educated. So instead of expressing them, I've kind of hidden in my foxhole. Part of it is I think that I see a lot of views from both sides. For example, if I were to take the view of how do we deal with the poor? For me, my faith informs me. I see verses in both the Old and the New Testament that talk like Zechariah does about not oppressing the alien or the poor. Or as Christ gives a command to the rich young ruler, doesn't tell him to sell everything and give it to the synagogue or to give it to the priest, but to give it to the poor. I see value there. But then I have to step away and I also see there's another side to that story. There are verses all over Proverbs that talk about the value of hard work. In 2 Thessalonians, it says, refuse to have anything to do with those among you who are lazy, who refuse to work. Don't permit them to freeload off on the rest. I see this balance that I'm not sure we can get. A lot of times I see my view in political discussions as maybe playing devil's advocate or being the contrarian, taking the opposite view and trying to ask questions in that person's terminology to foster some talking about issues. Let me give an example close to home. My husband, very soft at heart when it comes to people who are within his arm's length, but very black and white when it's out there. So when he's in one of his black and white out there moods, my questions become very personal, bringing that issue closer to home. That's where I see my role. I believe that a lot of times there are a lot of sides to issues, both good and bad. And people need to decide for them individually what fits best with their worldview. What are they willing to negotiate on and not negotiate on? I guess that's what I value about our political system, is it seems like as we have representatives, they get all of those views. And hopefully, if the system's operating well, then we have those people who are willing to work together with those different viewpoints for the best of the whole.
Well, as I thought about this, I decided that some of my very best political debates have been with myself. I tend to land on the conservative side when it comes to things like the sanctity of human life, the importance of traditional family, fiscal restraint. But what I find is that many conservative politicians are not as supportive of public schools, which is what I've given my life to. And I find a tension there between the right to individual rights and the good of the whole or the community. I do believe that every parent should have the right to say where their child goes to school. But if the funding follows, and if you go down that road and think about if most Christian parents pulled their kids out of public school, if most middle-class families pull their children out, then public schools that were designed to develop citizens for democracy are left with very few resources and the most challenging of children to bring along. And so where does the right to individual decision come and where does the greater good land? I once experienced this quite dramatically in that I was a principal of a public school. My husband was the pastor of a church that had a private school, Christian school there, and we had many homeschooled families there. And so I would have people come to me and say, where should I put my child? And my answer was, I believe a parent has to look every year at every child and say, this is the best place for them, because your first responsibility is to your child. We chose to have our children in public school because we believed that they were salt and light in public schools, and they took that role pretty eagerly. I can remember a time when I was pretty upset with what was going on down at that school, which sometimes happens to all parents, and I was ready to go off and stomp around. And my high school kid said, Mom, we know what we believe. We can speak up in class. We don't need you to be coming down there. And they did, and they were right. We did believe, however, when they got to college, that we wanted them in a Christian private environment, because those are the years when most of life's big decisions are being made. And we really wanted them around other people that would help them walk that journey and make good and wise choices. And the strategy seemed to have worked, because all four of them are ordained pastors, even the daughter, which could actually provoke a debate here tonight, probably, even there. But I actually believe it wasn't our strategy that did that, but I think it was the prayer that we prayed nearly every day of their lives, which was, God, whatever we do, it will not be enough, so please make up the difference. And we believe that he did. Now, in our family, we do have political disagreements. Among these ordained pastors, we have two registered Republicans and two registered Democrats. And some of that is based on life experience. Some of that is based on location. We've had several children who've worked in inner city ministries. That tends to lead you toward the desire for a little more government involvement with the great needs that you see. Our daughter lives in California, and was working with a Hispanic group in her church, and actually took her daughters out of school to go and march in solidarity with their brothers and sisters when all the immigration bills were being considered, because she wanted them to experience, here's how you stand up and try to make laws different that they believed were unjust and unfair. Would I have done that? Maybe not, but I certainly respect her for taking that stand and following through, as Martha suggested, because she knew those people. I think it's easier to have hard and fast philosophies when you don't have the faces in front of you. And I was once a principal in Central California with a school that had mostly maybe 89% Hispanic young children. And we had a breakfast program, and I would notice as the kindergartners were lining up for breakfast that there were some very tiny kindergartners. And I began to kind of watch, and I realized that some families were sending the little brothers and sisters along. And so it was my job to take that little person by the hand and walk them out to the car and say, you know, they can have breakfast this morning, but I need to ask you not to bring them back. And I had to do that because it was my job to take the money that was provided and educate and feed the children that the money was allocated for. But that didn't mean it didn't break my heart to have to say that, nor did it mean that I might not look for other ways to meet that need that was there. But I think it's easy to say, we're not going to give them any services until you see the beautiful little brown eyes looking at you kind of hungry. So I think that what Mike said, I want to reiterate that always with a political discussion, the relationship needs to come first. And I think that it's good to just say that, if we have this discussion, we both want to know that our friendship or our relationship in family will not be changed, or else we're not going to have the discussion and we'll just each research it in our own ways, because our relationship to one another is more important. And I spoke to my son, who's quite a Democrat, and said, what is helpful to you as we have these talks? And he said, I want you to challenge me and say, have you thought about, because we know we have that strength of nothing will change between us. And so I think checking that out, and sometimes I also think, and I was thinking of this quote today, it's a little bit generational in our view of how we look at things. This quote was attributed to Winston Churchill, but I think there's some question. He says, if you're not a liberal at 20, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative at 40, you have no brain. So that was his thought. But I do like another quote that is actually his. Courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen.
The world of politics, by definition, has tensions with the Christian faith. Running for office has tensions with the Christian faith, because Jesus said that those who rule in this world tend to lord it over their subjects. And yet they like to call themselves benefactors. They like to consider themselves as good for the people. So it's understandable that those who are in office or those running for office will try to emphasize all the good things they've done in life and minimize their bad things. Incumbents will point out their good success stories and not admit any mistakes. Challengers will do the opposite, point out all the mistakes of the incumbent and all the good things they've done. All politicians make promises of what they're going to do, and they either are sincere and realize they cannot keep those promises, or they're lying and they just say it in order to get votes. We Christians and all citizens must be people that would challenge those who run for public office. We need to challenge those who are in the political world, because we are called to be salt and light, and we cannot be naive. We need to be those people who will be that salt and question in a politeful way, in a respectful way, but we need to question and pursue, I suggest, three areas. First is the pursuit of truth. Politicians like to spin things. Experts at half-truths, exaggerations, distortions, and just bald lies. Let me take an example from our vice presidential candidates on the Republican and the Democratic side. Joe Biden said that John McCain's tax proposals for health insurance are the largest tax increase in the history of America for the middle class. That's a half-truth, because McCain is also giving a tax break for health insurance, which basically evens out and probably favors the lower income people more. So Biden says one thing which is true, but overall it is false. Sarah Palin, when her son went off last week towards Iraq, said, "My son's going to fight those who attacked us on September 11th. He was going to Iraq. Now, Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th, but that was a lie, that was a falsehood, stated early and kept on being stated. So you see mistruths, mistakes, half-truths on both sides. And Christians of all people are those who can say, my candidate did not tell the truth here, and the other candidate did not tell the truth here. So we should pursue the truth. Secondly, we should pursue accountability. We have a very relativistic society. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes. No one's wrong. And the two main candidates now are saying, the bailout, we need to solve the financial crisis. Let's not attribute blame. Let's solve it. And there's almost like a pseudo-Christian doctrine that we cannot assign blame. We should not judge. I think that is wrong. We reap what we sow. The crisis that we are in financially right now is due to policies and people and human mistakes. And if we don't assign blame, if we don't try to find out who made those mistakes and what mistakes were made, we will not correct them for the future. Other examples. Before we went to war, Rumsfeld, Hubbard, Cheney, Wolfowitz said the war would only cost $1.7 billion. It's $300, $400, $500, $600 billion, more or less. A whistleblower, Lawrence Lindsay, told an economic advisor to the president, told the president it's going to be $200 billion. Now, he was fired immediately for blowing the whistle. Wolfowitz was appointed president of the World Bank. To me, that is an example of bad mistakes getting rewarded and good whistleblowing getting punished. What would we say if our dean, Michael LeRoy, presented a budget to the board of $1.7 million? And over the year, it turned out to be $400 million. He would not get rewarded. He would get fired. He would not be welcomed back in Spokane, in the state of Washington. 2 minutes. I've got to go to my third pursuit. Pursue what is right. Politicians tend to pursue what will get them votes. They stick their finger in the air and see where the wind's blowing, and they do what is politically convenient. A couple days ago on this platform, Richard Schatz, our colleague, said, how is it possible that we can find $700 billion to bail out Wall Street and the banks, but we can't find $10 to $25 billion to provide adequate health care for all the children in our country? That is not right. 10, 20, or 30,000 kids will die today and every day because of poverty, lack of food, lack of potable water. That is not right. So we Christians should be, of all people, those who ask our politicians, do what is right. Now that gets into trouble because sometimes there's other values that push us in the opposite direction. After 9/11, we wanted revenge. We wanted to punish those who attacked us. Afghanistan might have been, and the Taliban might have been a correct way to go. But Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Yet the patriotic or the pseudo-patriotic fervor pushed us to approve a war that failed to meet every criteria of just war theory. And that's where Christians need to say, let us do what is right. Representatives, senators, president, do what is right and not what is convenient. And finally, we should not be one-issue voters if we're going to pursue what is right. I tend to side with Republicans on the abortion issue. I tend to side with the Democrats on the war issue, as far as you can see the differences. But if I were only a one-issue candidate and I would only vote for a party based on one issue, what about all those moral failures and bad policies of the Republicans? Or all the bad policies of the Democrats? We cannot give a blank check to any party or any candidate. Because if we align ourselves with that candidate, and that candidate has a lot of bad policies, our testimony is diminished. In the name of Jesus Christ, is aligned with bad policies. Let us pursue what is true. Let us pursue accountability. Let us pursue what is right. And let us examine all things and seek that which is good and discard that which is evil.
Lindy, I subtracted a minute from your time for that budget example, so. No. Yeah, that's right. No, thanks a lot. This was great. I heard, you know, a lot of great principles being articulated here, respect and dignity of the other, good critical thinking and our need to ask questions, sanctity of life, the common good, truth, accountability, authenticity. These are all really important principles, I think, that guide our behavior in, as we dialogue with one another. I want to shift it in a direction. I think a lot of people probably came here to figure out who you're going to vote for and see how they should have voted. So I'm going to turn up the heat a little bit. I'll start easier, though. I'm curious, what issue right now, not recognizing we're, no one here is a single-issue voter, no one said that they were, but what one issue is top of mind for you for this election? What is the one that you would counsel our students to pay some attention to this time around?
Okay. One of the issues that's important for me every election is speculating on who presidential candidates would appoint to the Supreme Court. When I went to graduate school, the most important thing I learned was in a freedom of speech class, and whatever you think law ought to be doesn't matter as much as it matters if five Supreme Court justices think something should be permitted or not permitted. The Supreme Court, in my estimation, has a tremendous amount of power and sway. And so I try to anticipate who are the kind of justices that Obama might appoint or the kind that McCain might appoint, and let that be some kind of guide and influence in my own thinking. That's tricky. There are lots of examples of where somebody thought a justice would be this way but has changed that way. But I think about that really in every election, and I still think it's critical in this one.
Do we only have to talk about the national election? Because I think in the state election right now, my concern is that there, and public schools may be my major issue, but there are many initiatives underway right now, and of course the financial situation may sabotage anything anybody wants to do, but I think I'm leaning toward keeping the governor we have in terms of moving forward with the initiatives that are going on to make public schools better in the state of Washington.
I don't like the question.
I knew you wouldn't.
I don't, because I think it's been used badly before. So I think for me it's to cherish life across the whole spectrum, which then means the sanctity of life. Who can best reduce the number of abortions? Who's concerned about health care for children and for all? Who will be moving forward on the immigration reform, comprehensive reform? Who will use our resources and plan for the future of this earth? Who will be concerned about the best interest? And this is not politically correct. Who is concerned about, and this is where Bush has done some very good things with Africa. Who's concerned about the people of the world and other continents? I think you need to be cherishing life across the spectrum and looking at all major issues.
For me, a lot of what I consider depends on what I'm looking at. For example, is it a state? Is it a national? Those things vary. I think I would side with Mike on a national level, that I think that's one of the things that probably the president has the most power over. They have to get votes for everything else, that too, but probably more power there. On local levels, depending on the position, there are a lot of other things that come into play. You know, if you want to take the commissioner of public lands, there's some other things. I don't think the Supreme Court preferences really have a whole lot to say. How they care about the world God's made has been a whole lot more important.
Feel free to respond to one another too. Well, I'm curious about who you're going to vote for or who you're thinking of voting for. But I want to ask this in a particular way. I want you to talk about who you're going to vote for, who you're thinking about voting for, and then I want you to give us one reservation that you have about that choice. So rather than tell us why you're going to, give us one reservation that you've got about that choice. And we're not going to check your voting record, so we won't know if you change.
I'm thinking about voting for McCain, but the reservation I have is that in the debate Friday night, I felt like Obama did a better job of articulating how you bring people together around important issues, and that disturbs me a little bit.
think I'm probably in the same boat of I'm probably preferring McCain, but right now my concern is the lack of any kind of regulations that might come into play, and we're seeing how that played out in the banking and mortgage industry, and I don't want it to continue on.
I want the last word.
I figured you would.
Shall we guess?
Well, I'm planning to vote for Obama. No, that's a lie. I was waiting for a bigger reaction from the dean. I plan to vote for McCain. I think that he represents more of the principles that I think are important, more of the ones I think are historically important. I buy a lot of the conventional analysis about is he really conservative or is he not? That gives me some trouble. And so one of the reservations I have, lots of politicians run on the edge and then move toward the middle in a general election. That's somewhat commonplace. But it appears that McCain has moved away from some positions that he used to hold. That troubles me in politicians generally. That troubles me in one that I'm going to vote for. So in my opinion, I wish that in the next 35 days he would state very clearly and be more consistent with what he's articulated in the past. I think that would be good and that would serve him well, but I'm concerned about that movement.
Although Obama and McCain do share many policies, immigration, global warming, etc., I will be voting for Obama. I'm nervous because in the debate, they're both trying, or Obama's trying to get the middle voters, the independent voters in the battleground states, and so he had to take a tough line because Democrats are not known to be as macho as Republicans. And so he had to take a tough line on Iran, and when he talked about making what the cuts would be, he did mention cutting defense. So he's moved towards the tough guy on certain issues. At the same time, he states that he wants to restore the U.S.'s influence and stature, moral stature in the world. So I hope he's running towards the middle to win, and then he'll be true to his root beliefs.
As a purist, I hope that none of you think the presidential debates are debates, because they're not. They're glorified press conferences. Tell your friends you're going to watch the GPC on Thursday night. That aggravates me to no end. If I could add on to the question, I hate when people don't answer the question. And I'm often critical of the debates, and I thought both McCain and Obama, though more McCain, didn't answer the questions. And I would love to see a better journalist try to pin people down into answering questions and what they're going to actually do and say.
I will say that several of our children are great Obama fans. In fact, we have
Hallelujah.
We have a Dutch daughter-in-law who became a U.S. citizen this year so she can vote for him.
Maybe you could say a few words about what leads you from an ethical or biblical point of view to kind of have the political philosophy that you have. And I'm not presuming that it's just a Democrat's philosophy or a Republican's philosophy. I mean, Lindy provided a really nice example of that. But if you could kind of provide a couple of principles, biblical principles, ethical principles that are guiding your thinking right now. And again, I think part of the reason I ask the question in that way is I know that there are a lot of them. And so but I also can think of the context that we're in leads certain principles to rise to the top more readily than others. So what principles? We'll take questions from the audience. Sorry, Martha.
I value someone who will try to work with other people. And to me, as much as McCain has gotten in trouble with his party for siding with the likes of Kennedy, get the right. Sorry, Biden was on my mind. Wrong Roosevelt. Anyway, I value that. I value the willingness to work with someone that maybe you don't totally agree with. There's got to be some of that.
Martha, I appreciate what you said about the scripture verses and calling people to hard work. And I think I've held to a conservative philosophy for a long time. I think that there are principles there about the role of individual responsibility. I think Christ calls us to be responsible human beings, stewards with his kingdom. He's given Christians a mission to accomplish. I think that those principles call us to some responsibility to ourselves and to our communities and to our churches. And so on balance, I think that there are more conservative programs or politicians who hold to that than do more liberals, but certainly not exclusive at all.
In my quiet time lately, I've been in Deuteronomy and just lots of commands there to take care of widows and orphans and aliens and treat them well. And I think actually both of these candidates, as you suggest, have really worked hard at helping us to get our immigration laws much more in line with the reality of how we use people. But it may be that McCain has more connections and more ability to actually get that done in the end. I don't know. And maybe not. But just that whole idea of, and it's a tension, I think, between, because if churches were always doing their jobs, maybe we wouldn't need so much government help on some of these things. But wherever we're helping to make life better, you know, I think you articulated that so well, the voting for life in whatever way that is. I wanted to ask you, though, do you go down that road all the way to no capital punishment?
Probably. Give people the last chance they can to repent, to turn around.
Because I find it so interesting that so many people are so pro-life at the beginning of life and are quite quick to stop life at the other end.
I think the principle that guides me is we should love our neighbor as ourselves, and the neighbor in the big sense that knows no national boundaries. And I think there's a false dichotomy. Frequently, I consider myself a very conservative, theologically conservative Christian. And that means we should love our neighbor as ourselves. I did my thesis in a conservative seminary on finances and economic relations in the Bible. And Paul has two whole chapters in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, on meeting the needs of a poor church in another country. So there might be equality. And so the fact that there are people dying today and every day means something is out of kilter. And I think there's a false dichotomy is that the church should do it all, because there are examples in the Old Testament, especially of the government of Israel and other governments taking initiative. And I'd be okay if Christians would take initiative and if they would say, we're going to cut our federal budget, but we're going to give a lot more as a local church. But I don't see that happening. So I think there has to be a hard working partnership between private and church giving, with government participating in the redistribution to meet the needs of the poorest people, both domestically and around the world. So that's where I think we Christians cannot avoid the command to love our neighbors ourselves. How we do it, sincere disagreements, but we are all under that command.
We want to take your questions now and questions for the panelists. I'll remind you, what we want are questions that are going to help us to have discussion and debate. You can blog your own statements or opinions. So we are really looking for the dialogue principle here. So as you ask those questions, don't be afraid of asking provocative questions that are going to get a conversation going. But again, we're not looking for statements.
My main concern with this election and then with the future of the United States, I guess, and the rest of the world, is the Iraq War and our continuing involvement there, or in some candidates' views, our exit strategy, more or less. And I just wanted each of you to comment on where you think we should go there. How do you think those issues should be resolved? And then strengths and weaknesses of your candidates' views and strategy as it relates to Iraq.
What's the saying? You break it, you bought it. And so regardless of whether we should or should not have gotten into Iraq, we're there now. I think that there, some of the Democratic candidates made statements about a timetable for withdrawal, and there were debates about how long that should be. As the son of a Marine Corps officer, I think there's got to be real prudence in the how the timeline of how you extract the military. You can't just pack it up and go. You just can't. So if you're going to have a timeline, you have to balance your ability to make that public and your ability to get that done. What I'd like to see connected, and I think McCain is a little better able suited to that, is to impose some more responsibility on the Iraqi government. I think there are legitimate claims where the Iraqi government has been lagging behind in responsibilities that it said that it would meet, and then it's not met that. So I hope that President McCain would say, here are benchmarks to you that you need to meet and proceed in a wise fashion to reduce our presence there.
I don't think we can eliminate the ethical question of was it a right war or not, not only because we need to be prudent about future possible wars, but when does a bad, immoral war become a good or neutral peacekeeping situation, which I assume that's what you would say. So we can't avoid the moral question, but even so, given the reality of the war as it is now, I think we do need a timeline precisely to force the Iraqi government to take action, which is good for their country and good for us. We have three children, all went through college, and we told them we will help you through college plus the duration and 6 more months. But after that, you need to be on your own and getting a job. So there needs to be that push of taking responsibility for their own lives. And I think, how can Iraq have $79 billion of oil revenues that they're just sitting in their bank and they're not covering basic expenses? So I think they have taken advantage of it. So I think Barack is right in saying, let's be prudent, let's get out as carefully of Iraq as we carelessly got in. So a timeline of 16 months, 18 months, and if you have to modify it, great, but at least put some pressure. And the Iraq itself and Bush himself are saying, yes, let's a time frame. So there's words and words, but I think that is helpful to push Iraq to take responsibility.
In Deuteronomy 17, it talks about when God's talking, basically handing down to Moses all the covenantal type laws, it talks about limitations on royal authority. And I don't know how applicable you may feel this is to our current day situation, but I think it's an interesting insight on human leadership. Essentially, God tells Moses that there are three main points when appointing a king that are pretty much necessary. And one of those is he can't acquire many horses, meaning large army. He can't acquire many wives, which would be alliances, connections. And he cannot acquire silver and gold, which means build a strong economy. So all of these things are obviously huge institutions in our modern-day American culture. And it talks pretty straightforwardly here against that as far as human leadership goes and human office. And I'm just wondering if you think this is a valid thing to look at in this presidential race, if you think it pertains to modern-day politics, and if we as Christians should maybe take it into consideration.
Yes. One of my favorite presidents was Dwight Eisenhower, who talked about the military, precisely one of the three that you mentioned, and that every penny spent needlessly on military prowess is a penny taken of food away from the mouths of children. So I think it's strange to me that evangelical Christians tend to be those who are most pro-military, and we should be reaping much greater peace dividends by diplomatically resolving conflicts, going the extra mile, trying to reduce military conflicts where possible, and seeking peaceful solutions. And I think Obama would do better there, but I do definitely think that the military peace thing is an important component given the dominance of military spending in our national budget.
It's interesting because I'm in Deuteronomy 16, so I'll read that tomorrow. But but I guess I wonder, in the spirit of all that Moses was saying to the children of Israel there, if part of that message is that those things not become the most important to that king, that the relationship to God and that God is the actual ruler of that country was the message, that these are the things that tempt us to make these alliances, to have great wealth. And, of course, we're not a theocracy. It would be nice if we were. But just that idea of looking for a person who isn't bound by those things or that doesn't covet those things so greatly that they would influence the decisions that they make. I think that's a real valid point.
I think I would agree with you that whole focus on a theocracy, and that as the head of that theocracy, the focus has to be that the sole provider is the Lord, that the other things are secondary. And I wish, maybe I don't wish, but that's not where we're at today. We're in a republic, and we live with all of our differences. And it would be nice to have someone whose focus was on the good of all. I don't know if that'll happen.
As we all know, we're in an energy crisis right now. And I just want to know what each of you thought about the candidates' views on energy, and particularly John McCain and him supporting the use of nuclear power and the recycling of nuclear rods, which is currently illegal, and no power plants being built in the last 30 years, I believe. What do you think about that, and what do you think could be alternative sources of energy as well?
Earlier I said the Supreme Court issue was number one for me. I think that's a pretty close second. I think that, and we're talking about this in Core 350, we've got to develop alternate energy sources. We can't rely on dead dinosaurs forever. There are challenges in going to nuclear. One is that some people say it's a good idea, but nobody wants the waste buried in their backyard, that there have been both Republicans and Democrats who have called for nukes, but who don't want it buried in Nevada, where it really can't hurt very many people, but there's been a lot of opposition to that. So to me, part of the question is, which candidate is going to be able to put some kind of coalition together to help the government move to solve that? People have been talking about disposal of nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain for, what, about a decade or so, I think. So who can help us move forward on that is going to be really valuable. There have been a lot of state governments who have had really interesting ideas about supporting alternate energy and providing tax credits for companies and individuals who add those kinds of features to their homes. So in my mind, who can help get that accomplished at a federal level, who can help get Congress to move to act, is going to be really important. And so if I answer that from a leadership perspective, I can see McCain being a little more successful on the Capitol Hill than I can Obama. But it's absolutely got to be done.
25 years ago, I was in Florida, and I rode an electric car that had been built 15 years earlier. It was designed, 30, 40 cars were built by a Florida man. That patent was bought by General Motors. And they sat on it, and they sat on it. And so I think we have subsidized and we've given big oil and the big car producers so many things, so much incentives in the wrong way, which not only makes us inefficient, it makes us dependent on oil-producing countries like Iran, Venezuela, et cetera. Therefore, we have to move in a different direction. There is sincere disagreement over whether nuclear energy is safe or not. France thinks it is right now with 80% of their energy coming from there. So I think it is possible. But we definitely need big, decisive steps from the president to reduce the oil subsidies and move into solar and other energy forms. I think it's going to be a Democratic House and Senate. Either president, either one could work with them on those issues. But I think Obama could do more with a Democratic House and Senate and fight less to get some of those issues passed.
I would tag on that. Where I would disagree with Lindy is what I like about McCain is he has a record. I mean, he's been in D.C. since 79, right? He has a record of getting some things accomplished. His name's on some significant pieces of legislation, and Obama doesn't. Now, Obama may be able to do that. I don't know. But in 4 years in Springfield and 3.5 in D.C., he's not done that. So that leads me to think that McCain's shown that he can do it. So I would bet on more of a sure thing than taking the risk of the unknown Obama.
Obama has Hillary on his side.
All the more reason to vote for McCain. And Sarah Palin, too.
Okay. My question is, there have been a couple of references to it already, but as far as the fact that we do not live in a theocracy. But when you listen, the four of you listen to the candidates speak, what is important to you as you listen to their faith statements or how they reflect their state, their faith, how they indicate that their faith may affect their leadership? Anything related to what's important to you as you listen to candidates?
Well, I kind of listen. This isn't scientific at all, but I sort of listen for, is there a relationship there? Is there some connection with God other than they all say, God bless you and God bless America? I mean, every single one. I just kind of listen for that. And in all the, every politician that I heard this year. So, you know, and I guess I'm glad that that still is part of our national dialogue. But I do read articles when I see them about how they describe their faith or how they make decisions, if there's any reference to that idea that prayer might be part of their world. Those are the sorts of things that I watch for, as well as their actions. You know, do they behave in a Christian way?
On the Republican side, I think McCain is very quiet about his faith, even when he's talked about it, about the cross over him when he was in Vietnam. But it's not the typical pious, conservative, evangelical lingo. Sarah Palin has that quite a bit. Obama's faith is much more justice-oriented, neighbor-oriented, very much of a Christian worldview that would come out of the Afro-American church, but also the Third World Church in general. And Biden is a Catholic, and he speaks about his wrestling with abortion issues or his wrestling with other issues. So I think all four of those of the candidates talk about their faith in different ways, but they're not the typical, at least McCain and Obama, are not the typical Bush kind of Christian. But I would rather have someone who doesn't talk perhaps as much about his faith or her faith, but someone who walks it across the whole spectrum.
I think that's one of the things that has probably made my wrestling with the candidates the most difficult, because I feel like in some ways Obama is better able to express his faith. That McCain, I'm not sure. I see it being walked out day by day, but I don't hear it. And I guess that's the part that I had to kind of go back and forth with as I was trying to make a decision.
Yeah, I would add to that that it's difficult for us from a distance to see both the walk and the talk. When you can see both, that's really helpful. But I think it's been really challenging this year to see both of those together.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, panelists. Why don't we give them a round of applause? I really appreciate that. They didn't know what kinds of questions I would be asking or what you would be asking tonight, and I really appreciate their candor. I hope you do, too. This is for faculty. This is not always kind of the way you want to be outed. But I think one of the things that you can and should know is that they do this because they want you to see the way that people of faith in this community can interact and engage on these issues. I do hope that one of the byproducts of this conversation is that you'll spend time with one another in Sodexo or in your room talking about these issues, that you'll seek out people that are different from you. I know Mike's example of with Jim McPherson, we all like to cite that around our campus, but hopefully we all like to live that too. And I know Mike and I have some of the same kinds of fun having conversations about our differences. And I learn a lot. I learn a lot by having friends who have perspectives that are very different from mine. So I hope you'll actively seek those out. I hope you'll model civil discourse and engagement with one another. I hope that where you see the kind of discord that's harmful, and by this I mean the opposite of the kind of values and virtues that we were hearing here tonight, you know, the kind of disrespect for one another, the kind of hateful speech that we can see in a political season, I hope that you'll challenge that and confront that as not living up to a standard of faithfulness, not living up to a standard of, I think, that we're truly called to be if we're going to be salt and light in this world. And if you get in a conversation, I really like that. I like that question. A student asked me, what's one reservation you have about the candidate that you're likely to vote for? It was a good question. It made me think hard and more deeply about it. I think if we can seek out that kind of dialogue where we can also be humble and acknowledge our uncertainties or our reservations, that's the kind of good, honest dialogue that will benefit us all. So thanks for your attendance tonight. We always like to end in about an hour, and I think we're faithful to that too. So have a good evening. Enjoy the rest of the week and this election season. Thanks.